Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for January 11, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and overlooking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. And, God, I haven't slipped up once so far this year and said 2006. I guess that's what happens when you get older. We've got two interview segments up tonight. In about 7 or 8 minutes, we'll be speaking with Steffi Woolhandler, who is a physician and also one of our leading analysts of healthcare economics and one of our leading advocates for a single-payer system. We'll ask her what's up with Arnie Care, what Arnold Schwarzenegger is hatching in California that's supposed to result in something like universal health care coverage. Well, we shall see what that means. And we'll also get an update from Steffi Woolhandler about what's happening in her home state, the Mitt Romney universal care scheme in Massachusetts. Several months ago, when that was unleashed, she was on here to say there was much less than met the eye in that case. I suspect that's what's happening in California. And there's a chance that the Democrats are going to try to generalize these schemes to the whole country. So we need to get on top of this. And then at the bottom of the hour, I'm very pleased to present an interview recorded earlier this week with Amiri Baraka. Who is, of course, a poet, an author, a political activist, and I think I was one of the more starstruck interviews I've ever done. I was a little intimidated by interviewing such a significant figure, but he turned out to be a nice and charming man. So we'll hear from him at the bottom of the hour, and also from a little bit from a presentation he did at the Naropa Institute in Colorado back in 1978, a little political manifesto and a reading of the poem Against Bourgeois Art, which is bracing in these days of political reaction. Speaking of political reaction, well, it's been amazing. The president, of course, proposing increasing the number of troops in Iraq last night, and instant poll by ABC shows the U.S. public opposed to this scheme by about a 2-to-1 margin. There's a little bit of objection coming out of Congress, although not as much as you might think. You have Joe Biden saying there's not much I can do about it, even though he is the Democrats' leading spokesperson on foreign policy in the Senate. But a very interesting point made in a and this is unusual to say something, interesting point made by Jacob Weisberg, who is the editor of Slate and a columnist in the Financial Times. But in today's FT column, he points out that there is a provision of the War Powers Act that states specifically that the president must remove forces when Congress so orders. So Congress is far from powerless. They could legislate the withdrawal under any conditions they like. Faced with military deployments they disliked in Haiti, Bosnia, and Kosovo, Weisberg continues, Republican lawmakers did not hesitate to invoke this authority during the Clinton years. Why is this not in wider circulation? I do not know. But in any case... just a few words about the economic news. Last Friday, we learned that employers added 167,000 jobs in the U.S. in December, more than most analysts, including me, were expecting, and a decent figure by recent standards. But it's a measure of how weak this expansion has been that a monthly gain nearly a third below the long-term average seems like a pleasant surprise. The goods-producing side of the economy had a very bad month, with construction off 3,000, more than all of that total, a decline of 16,000 in residential construction, the housing bust finally showing up in the jobs numbers, although non-residential construction gained enough to offset most of the housing-related losses in that sector. Manufacturing is off by 12,000 jobs, with the sagging domestic auto industry leading the way down. As has been the case for months, the biggest gainers were healthcare and bars and restaurants, which together accounted for a third of the total gain. And this has been a story month after month now. The relentless gains in healthcare are good news for healthcare workers, but not so good news for the rest of us facing ever-rising bills. By the way, the federal government shed 5,000 workers in December, continuing a long streak of shrinkage. From all the white right-wing bleeding about big government, you'd never know that the federal share of total employment is the lowest it's been since monthly figures began in 1939. Okay, so it looks like a tepid job market. But complicating the picture, hourly earnings for the average worker rose by 0.5%. And for the year ending in December, they were up 4.2%. That average for all private sector workers is dragged down by the sickly manufacturing sector. In private services, where about 80% of private sector workers are employed, yearly earnings were up 4.6%. To some, reasonably strong wage gains might be good news, but not to some on Wall Street and within the Federal Reserve, which sees these as profit-pinching, productivity-destroying, inflationary pressures. As I've pointed out here many times, this is the most class-lopsided economic expansion since good numbers began in the late 1940s. Profits are way up, and wages have been going essentially nowhere. If this keeps up, though, expect the Federal Reserve to resume the tightening jag it paused last summer, pushing up interest rates in the hopes of slowing down the economy and goosing up the unemployment rate. Because when the unemployment rate stays below 5% for any length of time, as it is now, and as it was in the late 70s even more so, then workers stand a chance of getting a raise, and bosses hate that. To keep up with population growth, we need monthly job gains of around 130,000. Anything above that means a larger share of the population will be working, which will push down the unemployment rate and tighten the job market further. It may not feel that robust to ordinary workers, but employers are bellyaching about how hard it is to find good help these days, and the lower the unemployment rate gets, the tougher it is for them. And this morning, the Labor Department reported a fall of 26,000 in first-time claims for unemployment insurance, suggesting that the job market is tightening further, though this weekly measure does tend to be volatile. As for that housing bust, which I mentioned earlier, the prevailing opinion on Wall Street is that the worst is behind us. That seems prematurely cheerful to me, and I have to emphasize again how weird it is to see rising house prices as good news. Why is it so good that one of the essentials of life gets continually more expensive? But support for the cheerful position on housing can be found in the latest application numbers from the Mortgage Bankers Association. After 2 weeks of sharp decline in mid-December, they were up strongly last week. It could be that once the Fed stopped raising interest rates, speculative juices started running again, and it's going to take another round of tightening to prick the housing bubble, finally. Either that, or huts will start running for $1 million apiece. And let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Steffi Woolhandler. And that's a little excerpt from Captain Beefheart's Dr. Dark from Lick My Decals Off Baby for about, I don't know, like 35 years ago. We are now joined on the line by Steffi Woolhandler, and that song has nothing in common with our next guest except for the name Doctor in the title. Steffi Woolhandler is a physician, a leading analyst of healthcare costs and spending in the United States, and also one of our leading advocates for single-payer health insurance. Welcome to WBAI, Steffi Woolhandler.
Glad to be here.
So let's start with Arnie Care. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, has unleashed a scheme that purports to aim for universal or near-universal health care coverage in California. What's up with that?
Well, the core idea is similar to the core idea of the recent Massachusetts bill, which is that the uninsured are going to have to buy their way out of their predicament. That is, the bills both contain a so-called individual mandate, which says to uninsured families, you must go buy health insurance. And if you make more than a certain amount of money, we're not even going to help you. We're not even going to subsidize you. In the case of Arnie Care, once you earn 2.5 times poverty, you're on your own in terms of paying for the health insurance. So we're talking about someone who earns $25,000 a year being mandated, forced by law, to go out and purchase private health insurance without any real help from the state. You know, the average individual policy in the state of Massachusetts is about $6,000 per person. In California, it's at least $5,000 per person. And I just don't think that you're going to see much new health care, much new health insurance, by telling someone who's only earning $25,000 that they have to take that kind of money out of their pocket.
Well, what's the sanction? What happens if they don't buy the insurance?
They're going to lose their individual state income tax exemption. In the state of Massachusetts, there's going to be additional tax penalties up to about half of the cost of the lowest price policy. So in the state of Massachusetts, if you refuse or are unable to buy health insurance, which I think is really the situation with a lot of middle-income people, they're just unable to afford the policy, they're going to have to pay several thousand dollars in tax penalties.
Well, we're talking, you know, you said 25, maybe even people with $30,000 incomes, which is a substantial portion of the population. The average household income is about, the high 40s somewhere. So we're really talking about a substantial portion of the population. They just don't have the money. I mean, how can you possibly require people to buy something they can't afford?
Right. Well, it's a little reminiscent of Marie Antoinette. You know, the poor have no health insurance. Let them buy health insurance. People simply don't have the money. That's why they're uninsured in the first place. Most people would greatly prefer to have health care coverage. People are not uninsured by choice. Many uninsured people have chronic illnesses. They have children. Many of them are middle-aged adults who know the consequences of going without health insurance. They simply can't afford it. But these plans have tremendous appeal to Republican types because they use the language of individual responsibility, but they also do the equivalent of placing a big tax on the uninsured people themselves. And if you say to someone earning $30,000 a year, okay, you didn't buy health insurance, we're taxing you $3,000, you know, you're penalizing you $3,000. That's a tax. It's a new tax revenue that's very regressive because it goes against really the middle-income families who can't afford insurance.
Well, this is really rich because the standard objection to any kind of public health care scheme would be that it would raise taxes. But this raises taxes in a totally unjust and also totally inefficient way.
Right, and it's quite covert. It's called an individual mandate, but in order to enforce the individual mandate, the government is going to use the tax code. It's also using the tax code to say to someone, you have to go out and give your money to a private health insurance firm. And, again, that's something kind of unique to place huge tax penalties on people unless they hand over their money to a private, often investor-owned, profit-seeking entity. So you can understand why it's popular with the Republicans who have, as you know, a tax policy of leaving the taxes high on middle-income people and giving the tax breaks to wealthy people. In fact, these new plans require very little out of wealthy people. It's really the uninsured themselves who are going to be footing the bill. The plan that the Arnie's proposing also includes a 4% payroll tax, and that is a somewhat more sensible mechanism than what we have in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, there's not even a real payroll tax. There's no contribution from employers expected beyond a nominal 15 cents an hour for uninsured workers. So,
would this apply to all employers or just those that don't provide health care benefits?
Just those who don't provide health care benefits. There is a payroll tax in Arnie Care, and there's not that in Massachusetts. But otherwise, the bills are very similar. They include a lot of provisions. There are some Medicaid expansions, which, of course, no one can oppose Medicaid expansions. They're relatively modest, going up only to 100% of poverty. So anyone who earns even a penny over 100% of poverty is expected to contribute money if they want health insurance under the plans.
But you said something about people over 2.5 times poverty have to pay all themselves. Is there something available for those between 1 and 2.5 times?
Yes. Between 1 and 2.5 times poverty, there are subsidies, though they have not even begun to talk about the size of the subsidies or the size of the premiums, though these subsidies will be phasing out at 250 top percent of poverty. So many of the near poor will, you know, get very paltry subsidies and be expected to chip in money or else perhaps pay these penalties.
What's the update in the Massachusetts scheme? I had you on here some months ago when it was first introduced. What's happening with it?
Well, they're rolling it out very slowly. And one of the best things that we could say about it when we first came on board was that they were rolling it out so fast that we were going to see it fail very quickly, and then we could move on to talking about real universal health care. They've slowed down the rolling of it out, so it's things have not changed a whole lot in the state. We did have a mechanism before called the free care pool where people could go to certain hospitals and get care for free, and they're turning down, they're shrinking the free care pool, they're increasing Medicaid HMOs, but the overall effect at this point is close to a wash. Not much has happened.
This is at a time when most states are very eager to cut or at least restrain the growth of their Medicaid spending, understandably because it's a tremendous budget burden for most states. So how can we reconcile these impulses?
Well, we need national health insurance. Every other developed country has some form of national health insurance, and every other developed country spends less than we do. In fact, the average for other developed nations is they only spend about half as much as we do on health care, despite having universal coverage. So the national health insurance is a much more efficient way of covering everyone. You do get rid of all of the insurance overhead. Typical private insurance in this country is about 13%, but some of the HMOs go up to 20%, even 25% overhead. 25% overhead means that the premium payer puts in a dollar, but only 75 cents would ever come out for doctors, nurses, hospitals, medications. The rest stays right there with the HMO. So relying on private insurance, as Arnie Care does, as Massachusetts Care does, as American healthcare does more generally, is very expensive and wasteful. And when you have a simple public system like Social Security, let's say, but for healthcare, you save so much money on administrative costs that you actually do have more money to provide care. The other thing, of course, with national health systems is it does facilitate better health planning. So you get the facilities where you need them, but don't duplicate them places where they'll be wasteful or even harmful.
Yeah, I want to return to this in a minute or two, but would it be feasible for a state like Massachusetts or California to do this right? If the federal government is not going to do it, could one of the states step in and actually insure most of its citizens?
Well, in many states, there are state single-payer laws, state single-payer movements. I work with a group called Physicians for a National Health Program. We have about 14,000 physician members, but many of our members do work in state-based coalitions to try to get single-payer bills debated and hopefully passed eventually in states. I think we do need a national solution, but we may be able to use a state-based system as a springboard to a national solution. That is, if one state manages to pull it off, that would be an example that would allow us to build the political will to get it nationally.
I think that's the way it happened in Canada, right? Didn't it start with Saskatchewan and then move through the provinces?
It certainly did. It started with a very liberal government. I guess they even called themselves agrarian socialists at the time. Government in Saskatchewan, they passed the first province-wide health insurance, but it was immediately so popular that the next year it was passed in British Columbia, which had a conservative government at the time, and then a year later it was passed nationally. One of the reason that we don't have national health insurance here is because the opponents of national health insurance keep it off the agenda with piles of misinformation by suppressing debate. And I say the foes really are the private insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industries, and they use their immense political and monetary power to try to prevent debate. So if you can demonstrate it in a single state, that has the effect of putting it on the agenda, letting the populace really look at it, understand it, and make a rational decision. And I think just looking at the international evidence, you have to say that national health insurance is the way to go if you want quality health care for everyone.
I'm speaking with Steffi Wohlhandler, who is a physician based in Boston, and who is also one of the our leading analysts of healthcare economics and one of our leading advocates for a single payer scheme for national health insurance. I know a lot of the unions have embraced payer play schemes, and they're not really fighting for a single payer plan. Do you have any understanding of why they're being so timid on this?
Well, last time health policy was really being debated nationally in the early 1990s, actually many of the union rank and file, many of the locals and state people, managed to fight the AFL and get them to put single payer on the table. So the AFL-CIO position in the early 90s was there are several alternatives. One is payer play and one is single payer. And that was really fighting from the grassroots, from the many progressive people who still work in the labor movement and still support the labor movement. At the current time, it's always more tempting for labor unions to just protect what they have and not think big. And protecting, if you have health care already, it's easy to think, well, we'll just protect that and not go for change in the big picture. Having said that, there are several unions who have always supported national health insurance. So, for instance, the United Auto Workers repeatedly have expressed their support for national health insurance. The UAW chapters in Canada are major supports for their national health insurance system. The steel workers have been very good. The PACE unions have supported single payer. So it would be wrong to see the labor movement as monolithically opposed to single payer. I think they're being somewhat pragmatic, I would say overly pragmatic at this point, but there are good people within the labor movement working to build single payer support. There's been a big effort to get the central labor councils of the state AFL-CIOs to endorse single payer, and 18 state AFL-CIO councils have endorsed single payer, and specifically the John Conyers bill, H.R. 676, also co-sponsored by Dennis Kucinich. So when we get out there and talk to the labor councils, we do find many of them willing to endorse the idea of single payer. We just don't make that same kind of rapid progress with the national feds.
I read in one of the newspapers today, I'm an old-fashioned guy who still reads newspapers, that Teddy Kennedy is flirting with some version of RNE care at the national level. Do you know anything about that? And, you know, more broadly, with this new Democratic control of Congress, is there any reason to hope for something more promising out of them?
Well, I do think there's reason to look for something more promising. Several single-payer supporters were elected this time. So three of the new congressmen who were elected ran on single-payer platforms, including, you know, several of these candidates I met at Physicians for National Health Program meetings. So we've got some real supporters of single-payer coming into the House, obviously very junior role. But supporters of the single-payer bill, many of them in the Congressional Black Caucus, are now playing leadership roles in the House. So, for instance, Rangel obviously has a very high position now in the House, and he's a single-payer supporter. John Conyers, who originated the current single-payer bill, is likely to be head of the Judiciary Committee. So we've got some very prominent players on Capitol Hill who support single-payer. Both Sherrod Brown and Bernie Sanders, who were elevated to the Senate, have signed on to single payer in the past, and Sanders has already expressed his interest in working to introduce a single payer bill. So the situation on Capitol Hill is better than it's been in a long time. Do we have the power right now to defeat the insurance and the pharmaceutical industry? Absolutely not. But given the level of problems that people are having with health care, do I think there's potential for building a movement strong enough to defeat the insurance and pharmaceutical industry? Absolutely, yes. And I think there's no other alternative for the United States, given how expensive health care has gotten, how it's interfering, as you pointed out, with state budgets. They can't afford Medicare. And how it's interfering with international competitiveness of U.S. firms who find they can no longer manufacture in the United States because jobs are running away to places with cheaper health costs. Not just China, not just Sri Lanka, but U.S. jobs are going to Canada and Western Europe because healthcare costs are lower in those countries.
And then finally, I want to expand on something you mentioned earlier. You talked about the tremendous amount of overhead with private HMOs and hospitals and our private healthcare system, which contradicts the usual image of the private sector as efficient and the public sector as inefficient. Where does all that money go?
Well, we've spent a lot of our research career, David Himmelstein and I, researching the overhead costs in American medicine. We've published half a dozen articles, most of them in New England Journal of Medicine or the Journal of the American Medical Association on this. So I think I can tell you pretty clearly where the money's going. Nearly a third of all U.S. health expenditure just goes for paperwork, overhead and administration. And if you look at countries
so that amounts to about 5% of GDP. We're talking about a huge amount of money that just goes to paperwork.
Just to paperwork. And if you had a system that ran as efficiently as, say, Canada's, you would spend half that much on paperwork. A big chunk of it stays right there with the private health insurance industry for their overhead and profits. So, for instance, Jack Rowe, a former colleague of mine, formerly of Harvard, most recent job was as the head of Aetna. He retired with almost $500 million in pay, equivalent to more than $200,000 per day that he earned in the 5.5 years he was at Aetna. So part of the money is going for these huge salaries, shareholders, returns, overhead at the private health insurance industry. Another huge chunk goes to the paperwork that hospitals have just to collect from insurance companies, huge paperwork burdens. The paperwork in doctor's offices, I am a practicing physician, and I can tell you it's literally huge what we have to spend and the amount of time we have to spend just to collect from insurance companies. But all up and down the line, when you treat healthcare as a commodity that's bought and sold, you end up with a tremendous amount of paperwork. If you treat it like a public service, like a fire department or a public school, then you don't have to do all that paperwork. You still have to keep track of where the money goes, but you don't have to figure out who's eligible for what service and who's got insurance and who doesn't and, what share the insurance pays and what share you have to bill. If it's a public service, then you simplify the administration, saving in this country literally $300 billion a year, and of course that's the money we could use to cover the uninsured, but also to improve the coverage for middle-class people who have insurance, only to find that when they get sick, things aren't covered. There's co-payments, there's deductibles, there are uncovered services, so much so that medical illness or medical bills is the second leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States, contributing to just about half of all bankruptcies. And it turns out that three-quarters of people in medical bankruptcy have health insurance at the beginning of the illness that bankrupts them. So even those of us who have insurance, we often are inadequately insured, have insufficient insurance to give us real financial protection if we have a prolonged, expensive medical illness.
I'm sorry, I have to cut it off there. We're just out of time.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Steffi Wohlhandler, who's a physician and leading advocate and analyst of health on healthcare economics. Let's take a break for station identification, and we'll be back with Mary Baraka.
This is Pierce Ficini in New York City.
And this is WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial and also at WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood, the program behind the news. And next interview was recorded earlier this week with the author, poet, and political activist Amiri Baraka on the occasion of his most recent book, just published by Akashic Books, Tales of the Out and Gone, a collection of short stories, many of them previously unpublished. Amiri Baraka sort of needs no introduction, but he is the author of many books of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. He and his wife, Amina Baraka, have run the art space Kamako's Blues People in Newark for the past 15 years. He was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 2001 and was a former poet laureate of New Jersey until he was New Jersey abolished that office for reasons you will hear shortly. He is a longtime resident of his home, the town he was born in, Newark, New Jersey, Amiri Baraka. Welcome, Amiri Baraka. First of all, forgive me if you're sick of talking about this, but I'm just wondering, what was the fallout of that 9/11 poem? Did you stay poet laureate of New Jersey? What happened?
Well, no, they don't have a poet laureate position in New Jersey anymore. That was I'm the last poet laureate of New Jersey. I mean, New Jersey has declared itself the nemesis of poetic license. So,
sad news for the state of Williams and Whitman.
Yeah, I'm telling you, we got the. It seems like all the poets who are known in New Jersey, whether it's Whitman who got fired, or Williams who they call the communists, or Allen Ginsberg who was born in Newark too, whose books were banned at first, and mine, seems like we all have a similar fate, you know, for some reason. Must be the water.
All right, well, let's talk first about this book. The first set of stories in it are from the 70s, early 80s, which are very much of the time when revolutionary movements were fresh and on the scene, and politics was very much at the forefront of American society. Things have changed considerably since then.
Absolutely.
But I'm curious that the Newark you portray in those stories, mostly with fictional names, is very different from the Newark of today, I presume. What is the Newark of Cory Booker like now?
Well, Cory Booker is, I put it this way. The people that I talked about in those early stories were part of the civil rights movement, in a sense. You know, they were our sort of native bourgeoisie, so to speak. You know, I mean, they were weak and feeble, but they did represent, to whatever flawed degree, those people. Cory Booker is a comprador. He's a Republican in Negro skin. He's from outside, and the first 90 days, he raised our taxes 8%. He fired 1,200 people. He brought in a police director who was with Giuliani, his name McCarthy. I don't know whether it's Joe McCarthy or Charlie McCarthy, one of those McCarthys, an unstable character who got busted himself by the police. And he's brought in people from New York and from the black people from the Ivy League and the white folks from Wall Street, and raised those salaries of his administration in some kind of obscene manner, where he has all these people making $140, $160, $170,000.
This is, of course, a city not with an enormous tax base.
No, in a city whose average wage is probably 20-some grand, you know what I mean? You get people governing them for $170,000. You know, it's really an obscene kind of thing. But you have to say this, he was voted in by the people. He was brought in $6.5 million with his treasure chest. He even had an ad on the Academy Awards program. I mean, to have an ad for running for Newark mayor on the Academy Awards program is a little unique.
That would suggest his audience is not the people of Newark.
No, not at all. And now he has to pay those people that put up that $6 million. All the development that's going to come must be to pay them back. You know, the arena comes in, which he steadfastly said he was opposed to when he was running, but now, of course, he's for it. And money that was supposed to go to various projects in the arts, he said, was really some corrupt Sharp James ploy. And he managed to stop that money, and now that money is being diverted to deal with that arena. So, but the people voted for Cory Booker because they did not understand who he was. I kept calling him a Trojan horse, you know. But now the enemy has come out of the inside of the horse.
Well, I was reading in today's New York Times a front page story about how Newark is on its way back, and this time it may be for real. What in God's name are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about displacing, I guess, 100,000 people. And they're building houses all over the place, which was actually initiated by Sharp James, which is going to be, you know, given a hard punctuation by Booker, that prices the people who live there out. You cannot possibly live in those houses. He said he wants to bring an additional 100,000 people. So it's a question of him moving 100,000 out who are going to be priced out, namely, you know, the older indigenous kind of mostly black and Latino citizens. and moving a whole, I guess they would be a middle management for the new infrastructure that they're building, you know, because they're going to put, they're going to make Newark a kind of, you know, they're going to gentrify it, make it a bedroom community for, you know, the city.
I guess you use a lot of the old-fashioned language, comprador and petty bourgeoisie, which warms my heart. But I was reading, doing some web research the other day and reading on your political history. Yeah. And it boiled down to, in the site I was reading, first with the Beats, then you're a black nationalist, and then you're a third-world Marxist. And that's where the history ended. What exactly is your political affiliation or philosophy these days?
Well, I'm still a communist, that's for sure. The question is, the organizations that we belong to split apart in the 80s, and we still put out a newspaper called Unity and Struggle that's been coming out irregularly. But those are some things that we have to do. And so I've been taking time out recently to, you know, publish some books, get some books published. But I still want to put out a newspaper that is literary and political, or let's say cultural and political. I still want to do that. Still want to, you know, put on more theater. So we're endeavoring, you know, we've had some hard luck. You know, we just had my wife and I were just in an accident, auto accident 3 weeks ago. She knocked out all her teeth, and I hurt my back and my butt. You know, somebody hit us from behind, kept going. So, I mean, it's been a series of bad things that have been happening to us, but, you know, we'll recover.
How do you practice Marxism in a country that is overwhelmingly white and deeply individualistic in its cultural politics?
Well, I would say this. The strongest elements of the left are in the black and minority communities for obvious reasons, because they're the ones that still strive to raise the level of their own lives. A lot of the people who back in the 60s might have seen, you know, a common front with us have since left. And then even the young blacks and Puerto Ricans, a lot of them who've been raised up post-civil rights, post-struggle, they don't relate to, say, you know, the Congress of African People, the Black Panthers, or the Young Lords, or, you know, the Revolutionary Communist League, or the October League, you know. And so this is a kind of post-revolutionary period in the United States. Actually, it's what Du Bois called the Sisyphus Syndrome. You know, where you roll the rock up the mountain and they roll it back down your head. Well, George Bush represents the rock rolling down. I guess it's been rolling down really since Reagan. I don't think Clinton was much good either. But we've reached, I guess, the nadir. Well, he wasn't much good either. But we've reached the nadir of all of this rock rolling down. And it's time to reverse that. Even though, I mean, the Democrats have pulled a little, you know, toenail victory. But I think it's important that we see that that struggle is just begun. You understand? And the fact, well, I think George Bush and them should go to jail, but the fact that there is some daylight now, I think that might be the reason that I'm getting better reviews and things like that, that the political sort of trend has been reversed, is beginning to be reversed. But there's much more to do. We have to change the political culture in this country. And I think that a lot of us who are on the left, communists, Marxists, what have you, have to see that our role is to get the people to understand that they have to transform the political culture of the country itself, you know, to get rid of the Electoral College, to get rid of private monies in elections, to get to one person, one vote, you know, to get rid of the winner-take-all system, to get rid of the Senate and only have one House of Congress with one person, one vote. To have all the elections on the same day. In this country, this advanced, you know, imperialist country, these are the tasks that we have to face in building national organizations and national communications that can put that out.
I noticed you said earlier you were interested in starting a paper that did both culture and politics.
Yeah.
You yourself do both culture and politics. Your writing is sometimes very political and sometimes highly experimental and not paraphrasable narrative. How do you reconcile those? Are they two sides of the same thing, or are they like two different worlds?
Well, what it is that my kind of experimentation has always been part of my writing. You know, some of the early stories in this book are meant to present what I see with a kind of almost journalistic accuracy, you know, so that you know that, you know, like you say, you are there, so and so.
Well,
and so
I thought when I was reading the earliest stories about Newark, it can learn more about how Newark works than reading a year's worth of newspapers.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And that's, since I was on the inside of that, you know, helped elect those first black politicians and, you know, later then understood that getting rid of the white folks alone was not going to help, since there were classes and class struggle in the black community. And that information I had to really grasp and to move on. But the last part of the book, the stories are more fanciful. They're more like science fiction or fantasy tales, because then I wanted to take some of that information and experience and see, could I utilize that in more experimental kinds of forms, but still talk about the things that I think need to be talked about.
I'm speaking with the writer and activist Amiri Baraka, whose latest book is Tales of the Out and the Gone, just published by Akashic Books. Yeah, I think a lot of people who do political art try to make it very straightforward, simple, almost didactic, and highly accessible. You don't share that point of view?
Well, I think that's good, but I think that, you know, I think that's good, but I think there's that realism in that sense is not necessary, not necessarily the best way to show reality. You know, if you understand, say, in Japanese painting, Chinese painting, where there's one stroke on the papyrus, so to speak. No, there are many ways to tell reality, and I think somebody like a Henry Dumas or Octavia Butler, or for that matter, I take that kind of story. Also, I influenced by people like Kafka and Ray Bradbury and Isaac Babel and Usman Simbeini, where you can tell a short story and do anything with that, but still be talking about the same kind of conditions and the same kind of life in reality that you have to talk about.
One of the stories seems to be based on this, but you spent time in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And you said that's where you had most of your education.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was, I got kicked out of college, and I was so embarrassed by that I joined the Air Force, where, you know, eventually I got kicked out of the Air Force, so I was going two for two. I was a weatherman and a gunner on a B-36. Most of the time, I spent guarding airplanes in the daytime. And at night, I was the night librarian. So I had access to the library, me and a group of my pals. And I was in charge of it, actually. I ordered all the books, all the records. The woman who ran the library was one of those social service people. They wear the little uniforms and go around from island to island and base to base. But when she saw that I actually loved books and knew what I was doing, I didn't see her no more. She gave me the key. So I ran the library at night. And that library in Strategic Air Command became known as the best library in SAC. You know, even with crazy Curtis LeMay as the head of SAC, we had an incredible library, incredible music library that went back to Gregorian chants and motets and Brahms and Beethoven, as well as all the jazz. And then we had the most contemporary library. What I would do is I was, you know, because I was learning, I would read the New York Times book reviews and order the stuff I thought needed to be ordered or that. And then I would always be digging through different stuff and find out different names that I might not know and order them to find out. You know, like I always told a story about Kafka. These guys say, "Hey, Jonesy, what's a Kafka?" "I don't know what a Kafka is. Let's order it." And that way, to me, is the best education, talking to each other directly about ideas. You know, the sort of old bank deposit idea of depositing something in somebody's head, as one Brazilian writer pointed out a long time ago, is not as effective as open discussions of the material. You read. Now, what did we read? You know, discuss it.
I was listening to you read an old poem, Against Bourgeois Art, last night, and but evidently you're not entirely against bourgeois art. You seem to have consumed a large quantity of it.
Well, I think that's the problem. You know, you are raised that way, and you try to glean the best out of that. You know, what's the most important stuff, you know? And there've been a whole lot of great writers that I've been deeply influenced by and would call in a minute. But you have to pick your way through the most backward to get to the most progressive. I mean, there's some writers, grand writers, and many of the even the white American writers are their works are not done, or even, you know, European writers' their works are not done because they're too progressive, and that you have to understand which authors really are talking from the side, from the point of view of the people, the point of view of transforming society, you know. And sometimes writers even uneven. One story is backwards, one story is progressive. I mean, Hemingway, something like that. But there's a treasure chest of literature out here, you know, and even among all the so-called bourgeois artists, a lot of those artists are great writers. You know, I mean, if you can read Mark Twain and Herman Melville, you know, those are great writers. You know what I mean? And they have a progressive point of view, you see. But you have to either learn that yourself or be taught that by people who know, you know.
Yeah, well, I think a way that a lot of literature is used is in a Matthew Arnold fashion of disciplining people and it's sort of uplift in the sense of conformity.
Gee, Matthew Arnold, I haven't heard that. The poem, what was it, Dover Beach, we had to read in college. It's a long time ago.
In conclusion, tell us about what's in this book.
Well, this book of short stories from 1975 until 2003, you know. And there's stories that I've been collecting. I have some more that are not in there. These are some stories that really show the motion of my own mind and material life, those 40, you know, those, 30-some years, you know. And like I said, some of them are really kind of almost journalistic. Some of them are very sort of fantasy-like in form or the content. I hope still talks about those things that are important to me in the world.
And a lot of them had not been published before. Why is
that? A lot of them not published before.
They're just sitting in the drawer?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for various reasons. Some of them were published, some of them half published, and some of them I just didn't get around to it, you know. And then, of course, the context changes. The United States has changed, and a lot of the wild stuff that we would do in the 60s and 70s, by the time to the 90s, are no longer you able to get that over. I've gone through a little thermidor with people not being interested in my work, but I just had to keep plugging.
And that's the voice of Amiria Baraka, the author and political figure, playwright, excuse me, whose latest book, Tales of the Out and the Gone, is just out from Akashic Books. And I found that book engaging, gritty, realistic, fanciful, and often very funny, really, really fine stuff. So check it out. And I came across this on the web the other night, a recording of a 1978 appearance by Amiria Baraka at the Naropa Institute in Colorado, in which he is introduced by a very choked-up Allen Ginsberg. And then Baraka reads a little political manifesto and the poem Against Bourgeois Art. If you want to find this, it's on archive.org. On the web, just search for Baraka Naropa. And let's listen to some of that.
When Malcolm X was shot, a good deal of the weight and responsibility for leadership in the black American nation fell on Leroy Jones's shoulders. His name became Amiri Baraka. There were enormous political changes. He was beaten by the police, jailed, underwent trials, many sufferings, having become isolated from some of his earlier friends, surrounded by government agents, surrounded by all the paranoia that the CIA and FBI could pile on his head. So that there was a long period of paranoia and separation. I'm really happy that he's here with us now. There's some kind of reconciliation, a meeting. In Kerouac's poem on heaven, the characterization of the present poet was Leroy Soft.
Art, like everything else, reflects at one point the class struggle within society. America is a capitalist country, and art, literature put out and supported by the rulers of this country is a capitalist art, a bourgeois art, an anti-people art. For instance, they talk about art for art's sake, but all art serves the needs of one particular class or another. Artists have a choice, and it is simple and straight out. Either write for the people, write to transform society, write for revolution, or write in support of the people's enemies. The academic poetry of America, largely a middle-class poetry written by middle-class academics aimed at the middle class, and the bourgeoisie too, since they need grants, reflects work and study irrelevant to transformation of society. Our poetry must reflect our work. The artist either serves the people or serves the bourgeoisie. We must represent that which is living and coming into existence, which is the proletariat, the working class, the masses, and the revolutionary struggle. We must oppose what is dying, hence going out of existence, the bourgeoisie, capitalism, bourgeois ideology. Art must be a weapon of revolutionary struggle. I believed that even when I was a backward cultural nationalist and thought all white people were the enemy in that confused morass of self-contradictory bourgeois ideology. But the struggle to make change, the fact of active participation in that struggle, neocolonialism, petty bourgeois elites of black elected officials, failure of cultural nationalism, all contributed to my change of ideology. But I still say art must be a weapon of revolutionary struggle, that all art is propaganda, although not all propaganda is art, as Lu Xun said. We must struggle to make an art, a poetry, that is politically revolutionary and artistically powerful. This is called Against Bourgeois Art. War on the horizon. A ship with a bloody sail. Andy Young slips on his Chamberlain appeasement get-up he got from years listening to the CP hype Martin Luther King. Is there somebody here to record this? United States being thrown out the front door, the Russian bear charging through the back door. Carmichael suddenly, clearly an apologist for new style colonialism, telling us we can't fight in the United States, though centuries of our blood, centuries of our dead are buried here. Oceans of our blood have fertilized a black nation, Afro zone in the South. Is there someone here to get this down? Can I get a, like they say, witness? An eye that can see through this here? In Jimmy Carter's Snake Oil show, there is a room nobody talks about. A steel door, fumes seep underneath. Inside, blood and hair on the floor, bones stacked in the corner, photos of Goering and Goebbels and Joe McCarthy and Nixon in the nude trying to put helmets on their pecker woods. Will somebody put this stuff out? You walk through a museum, all the colors of the spectrum right there, but not one image except of checks passing, Pollock dollar signs, de Kooning fortunes, Larry Rivers pots at the end of the rainbow. No people, no love, no heart and soul insides flowing out, no fighting in the street, no fires rip the sky, no children screaming death, no police, no state except it is the state bullshitting on the wall. No people struggle, just colors thrown by baby snooks. A down and leaving unintellectual. No record of this place. As wild a motherfucking joint as America is, somebody should get this shit down. Otherwise, no one will believe it. Get it down. Get it on the record. Get the hate, the horror, the lies, the Rockefeller monsters eating corpses. Hey, bro. Say, hey, what it is, dude. Yeah. Do it, do it. Is you? Wow, loud. Duty Roo, baby, baby, baby. Carrying the radio on his shoulder. They eating corpses. Coal mines, garment center, assembly lines, hot steaming steel poured through space. Not any of life is there. Hey, poet! Hey, poet! Hey, poet! You artist! He turns in the shadows, sucking a marble, dribbling Andy Warhol's lost nut. He is an artist. He is a poet. A Poe 9, too. His work is about everything. His work is about the universe. Her work is about stars belching. Her work is about gray hair lost in the desert, peeped in a teeny voice. No babies, no screams, no red life, no future. Death peeped in a teeny, teeny voice. Stupidity dripped in a sultry voice. Bourgeois poets yodel nonsense about boring absence. They think up funny ways for letters to sit on the page. Concrete bull, already dumb. They are safe as old toilet paper. Revolution sweeps the world, but bourgeois artists stare at crumbs of dust in the light. People struggle, change reality, but these dull imitation poets talk to us of fragmented nothingness, like two-cell creatures trying to bebop. The world is heavier than they know. They do not know. They fight knowledge with abstraction and think they cool because they talk to themselves. They are full of like vultures snacking on an open grave. They uphold dying capitalism and give themselves airs. They think they is profound and complex, but the people think it is as profound and complex as monkey farts. Now, meditate on that.
And that, Amiri Baraka, reading in 1978 at the Naropa Institute in Colorado. And before that, a little political excerpt from a political manifesto. And then before that, he was introduced by Allen Ginsberg, who was very choked up, having apparently not seen him in quite some time. And this was only about 6 or 7 minutes out of a program that's about an hour and a half long. So you can find it on the web at archive.org. Just search for Baraka and 1978. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with Satoshi Tomy's take on one of the classic bits of contentless rage you could ever ask for. This from live at Saw Radio Mix 2005, Satoshi Tomy. Till next week. Bye.
Get up.